Well, good morning, everybody. How many of you were here last night? So, and quite a few were not, correct? Right. Well, so we're studying, reading the Mahaparinirvana Sutta. And I began last night with the first, maybe third of the sutta. So I think I have to review for those. I kind of, in my mind, I thought, oh, I'll just do go through. But now I realize I have to review a little bit. So for those of you who were here, you'll remind me if there's something I left out in my little review that I left out that was important to you. Listen for that, and then I'll ask you, I'll remember to ask you at the end to add whatever I might have forgotten. So I'm going to try to catch everybody up who wasn't here last night. So the Mahaparinirvana Sutra, or Sutta actually, is a more proper way to say it, is the longest sutta in the Pali Canon of Theravada Buddhism. It's part of the collection of the Digha Nikaya, the extended length suttas. And it's the story of the Buddha's last months and of his passing. And I was saying last night that we've studied this sutta before, but we have a Dharma seminar at home and we were studying about death and dying in our Dharma seminar, and reading books and talking about it. And during the Dharma seminar, two people in the Sangha, very close members of the Sangha, died during the Dharma seminar on death and dying, which was rather a dramatic thing. And so that became part of it. We all went, sat with those members who had passed, and we did all the... There's a lot of rituals. You know, somebody asked, what's the difference between Zen and Vipassana? And one of the main differences is that Zen has a whole, it's like a religious tradition. So there's a whole series of many, many rituals. So lots of rituals having to do with death, rituals at the time of sitting with someone who's died, rituals at the time of the cremation ceremony, rituals for a funeral, rituals for burying or scattering ashes. So it's a very intense time. And to have both two people in the same relatively short time frame was quite something. Anyway, and as I said last night, and I'm never going to do a seminar on death and dying again. I don't want anybody that I know to die anytime soon. So, do me a favor. Don't die anytime soon. Wait till later, you know, much later. Okay? Do me a favor. Personal favor. Anyway, after that, we said, well, let's study the Mahaparinirvana Sutta because let's see how the Buddha went and did this. Right? So that's why we then next study the Mahaparinirvana Sutta. So anyway, now I'm going to review the beginning of the sutta. It begins with, we hear that King Ajatasattu, who appears a lot in the suttas, he's the king of Magadha, where the Buddha often was. He decides he's going to invade and destroy. It doesn't say why, but he just has this idea. I have a great idea. I'm going to destroy and wipe out these people. I'm going to conquer them, he decides. So he then sends an emissary to the Buddha to get the Buddha's, you know, what do you think about this idea, Buddha? And you would think that the Buddha would say, oh no, you know, war is terrible, it breaks the precepts, it hurt people, don't do it, war is no good. But he doesn't say that at all. He just says, okay, that's your idea? Okay, good. Well, let me ask you some questions about the Vaijans, these people that you're proposing to conquer. He asks a bunch of questions about them, and he finds out that the Vaijin people are very nice people, that they are a very coherent community. They meet frequently together. When they meet with a lot of civility. They don't yell at each other. They're very harmonious. They take care of their elders. They recognize the religious leaders and respect them, and all these things he finds out about the Vaijins, including very specifically that they don't do cruel things to women, which seemed to be a very important point in this list of characteristics of the Vaijin people. So the Buddha then says to the emissary, well, since you're reporting all this about the Vaijin people, I would say to you that the Vaijin people are going to be very difficult to conquer because, you know, they're going to have a lot of inner strength and support among themselves because they behave in this way. So all I can say is it won't be easy to defeat them. So the emissary leaves and thinks to himself, well, I better tell the king that maybe it's not such a good idea to attack the Vaijin people. Maybe this will be a lot of trouble. So let's not attack them. But then he says, well, I think I'll advise the king that he should, like, instead of attacking them with an army, he should attack them with propaganda and try to create dissension among them. And once they're weak because of their dissension and they're fighting amongst each other, then we can conquer them. So this, all of this has echoes for our contemporary world, doesn't it? Anyway, that's the first thing. Oddly enough, that's the first thing that happens in this sutta. And the reason why it's mentioned is because this seems to give the Buddha a good idea. And he assembles all the monastics in the area and he starts giving them speeches about how... should it ever happen that I'm not around anymore, the Buddha says, these are some of the things you should pay attention to so that you can have a good community, and you should meet together in harmony, you should respect your... all the things that the Vaijins did, he says the Sangha should also do, in addition, of course, to many other things, like particularly keeping the monastic rule, keeping good ethical conduct, you know, doing the practice, honoring the elders. But his... hearing about the Vaijins gave him this idea, and he gathers the Sangha together and gives them many, many lists of things that they should be doing to ensure their future. And then he goes forth traveling around, and wherever he was traveling, he gives the same Dharma talk. and it's repeated over and over again in the sutta, and the Dharma talk is about 3 sentences long. And I will quote it for you. This is morality. This is concentration. This is wisdom. Concentration, when imbued with morality, brings great fruit and profit. Wisdom, when imbued with concentration, brings great fruit and profit. And the mind imbued with wisdom becomes free from the corruptions, that is, from the corruption of sensuality, of becoming, of false views, and of ignorance. And that was his Dharma talk. And we could imagine that that was probably like notes, you know, like shorthand. He must have elaborated probably on each one of these points quite a bit. And that's what I did last night. I elaborated on each one of these points. And I won't do that again. I won't repeat all that. Just to say that in the Buddha's, for the first point was the importance of morality. And in the Buddhist scheme of understanding life and practice, morality is really, really important, because without morality, you can't meditate. Your mind is nervous, confused, paranoid. You can't sit still. You can't really... So in other words, the proposition of Buddhist meditation is not just producing laser focus, intense concentration. It actually is about having a good heart, caring. In a word, you know, morality, meaning, not adherence to abstract moral concepts, but being kind, being caring, you know, not doing harm. And that's a cornerstone of the practice. He wanted to make that clear to people now that he's coming to the end of his life. So over and over again, wherever he went, he kept saying that. And I'll skip all the whole part about my commentary to all that. Again, one more point that might be worth saying is that the Buddha seemed to have a lot of faith in human nature, in human beings. Despite the tremendous, almost overwhelming evidence to the contrary, the evidence would lead almost anybody to believe human beings are terrible creatures, you know. They're nice in some ways, but in the end, they do awful things, you know. Mess up one another, unfair, injustice, horrible stuff. And then they wreck the planet Earth. I mean, you know, it's hard to think that human beings are good. But the Buddha actually thought that the natural state for a human being was kindness and love, and that when human beings have been hurt, they do bad things, but this goes against their basic nature. That this seems to be part of the content of the Buddha's awakening, was to recognize that this is the nature of the human heart, the human soul, although Buddha didn't like that word, soul. But and he must have found that in himself. And I made the remark last night that I don't think anybody is going to prove scientifically with data that human beings are good or that they're bad. I don't think anybody is going to prove this point one way or the other. However, if you're a human being, it's a very good idea to imitate the Buddha and have faith in humanity. Why? Because you're a human being. And if you don't have faith in humanity, it actually is not possible to have faith in yourself. And if you don't have faith in yourself, well, it's a rough life. So I think that this is a good reason all by itself to practice Buddha Dharma. If it gives you faith in humanity and faith in yourself, that already is a worthwhile thing. So then the Buddha went traveling again, and he gave a teaching about the five disadvantages of unethical conduct, which I won't repeat, but it just goes to show you he's thinking a lot in these last months of his life about the importance of ethics and morality. Not about enlightenment, not about deep meditation, but about just solid ethical conduct. Next is a funny incident that happens with Ananda. Ananda, a lot of people in the Buddhist Sangha also had recently died, and so Ananda was wondering, you know, what is the fate of all these people who died? Where are they going to be reborn? What happened to them? So he lists all these names of these people, and he asks the Buddha, what about this one? What about that one? And the Buddha, each one, he says, well, this one is an arhat, you know, they're fine. This one, they died, and they're in the in-between state, but the next life, they're going to be have a good birth and be a Buddha. He goes through the whole list. And at the end of this episode, he says, Ananda, this is very tiresome. You know, you're asking me about all these people. So from now on, and you can see the Buddha thinking, you know, I'm preparing everybody, right, for when I won't be here anymore. So he said, in the future, you know, if just in case I'm not around to be asking this anymore, there's a way of telling what your spiritual state is. And he calls it the mirror of Dharma. Just look in the mirror of Dharma and you'll be able to know what your spiritual state is. So the mirror of Dharma turns out to be having full and unshakable confidence in Buddha Dharma Sangha, and guess what? Practicing ethical conduct. If you have these things in you, you know that your spiritual state in future is going to be very good. So then the Buddha goes to the grove of Ambapali, a courtesan, where he's now with his disciples camped out, and she's later in the sutta gives the grove to him. And then there's a funny episode about her where she comes and invites him to a meal, and he agrees to go to the meal. And then just as she's leaving in her chariot, the chariot of the Lichavis, who are like big high-class people in the area, she smashes into their chariot just as they're coming, she's leaving, and she says to them, more or less, "Well, I just would like you to..." They say, "Why did you smash into us?" And she says, "Well, I just wanted you to know that the Buddha is coming to my house for the meal." She says, you know, probably with some attitude, I'm guessing, you know. And the Lichavis are really upset about this, and they say, "Damn, you know, we wanted the Buddha to come to us." And they said, "We'll give you like 100,000 million pieces of gold if you let the Buddha come to our house instead of yours." And she says, "Oh no, there's no way." So then they go to the Buddha and they ask him, "Come to our house." And the Buddha says, "Oh, sorry, I'm already going to Ambapali's." And they say, "Damn." And so it's kind of a funny, you know, the Pali Suttas, in my opinion, they're like very soberly written by our contemporary standards, you know, pretty deadpan, low key. But I think there's a lot of very funny things in them that you wouldn't kind of know they're funny until you think about them. And to me, this is a very funny episode, especially because the sutta mentions that the Lichavis had gone to see the Buddhas all dolled up, and specifically with their red and blue makeup on, it says. So you can imagine the Lichavis showing up blue and red in the face, you know, with all this fancy Indian makeup on, which I guess, I was just thinking about that. Like, in nature, isn't it almost always the case that it's the males of the species that are all fancy, right, to attract the females? How come it isn't that way in the human world? It seems the human world, we think it's natural to women to want to be, you know, have their hair done and makeup and all this, we think, and not males as much. I wonder how that happened. You think that's, did we invent that, or was that, I don't know how that happened. But anyway, in India in those days, no, it was, I don't know, I mean, the women were probably dolled up too, but so were the men, very elaborately. Anyway, that happened. And then I ended up with this quotation from the text. And this will be the end of my review, unless I forgot something important, and then we'll go on to the next part. So here's the rather lengthy quotation from the sutra. "When the Blessed One had entered upon the rainy season, there arose in him a severe illness, and sharp and deadly pains came upon him. And the Blessed One endured them mindfully, clearly comprehending and unperturbed." You would think that the Buddha would like be beyond pain, but no. He endured. The word endured tells you that this really was painful. But he was mindful and clear-headed about it. In other words, he didn't freak out and complain and yell. But it was definitely unpleasant. "Then it occurred to the Blessed One, it would not be fitting if I came to my final passing away without addressing those who attended on me, without taking leave of the community of bhikkhus. Then let me suppress this illness by strength of will and resolve to maintain the life process and live on." And the Blessed One did suppress the illness by strength of will and resolved to maintain the life process and lived on. So it came about that the Blessed One's illness was allayed. And so he recovered, and he came out from his dwelling place, and he sat down in the shade of a building. And then Ananda came and said to him, more or less, "Oh, I'm so glad that you overcame that illness, because I was so upset, you know, to see you sick. And it was like my own body became weak just with the thought of it. It's like the whole world sort of dimmed. Colors weren't as bright. I felt like I was failing. And yet I took comfort in the thought that the Buddha wouldn't pass away until he had given some last instructions to the community. And that cheered me up." And then the Buddha sort of surprisingly almost scolds Ananda and says, "Last instructions, last instructions? You think I'm supposed to give last instructions? I don't see myself as like this great Buddha who's supposed to give last instructions. If somebody thinks they're a great Buddha and wants to give last instructions, let her or him give the last instructions. I'm not doing that." It's kind of surprising that he would say that, but he did. And somebody said, "Well, what? The Buddha didn't think that he was the leader of the community?" And I said, "Well, he must have, of course, he understood his role in the community, but I think he was reacting to Ananda saying, 'We're depending on you.' He wanted everybody to realize, you know, it's a mistake to depend on me. You have to really depend on your own practice. Yes, I'm fulfilling my role. I'm going around. I'm, you know, doing what Buddhas are supposed to do, and I will do that until the end, but don't depend on me. Don't project onto me your spiritual needs. It won't work." That's my interpretation anyway. So then, now I am frail, Ananda. I'm old, I'm aged, far gone in years. This is my 80th year. 80 doesn't seem that old anymore, right? You think 80, man, come on, Buddha, buck up. 80's not that old. Just, you know, you're just entering old age, right, at 80. Ha ha, we think. You know. "And my life is spent," he says, "even like an old cart, Ananda, held together with much difficulty. You know, strapped together with duct tape and chewing gum. That's like my body, just barely holding together. And it's only when I ignore external things and let go of certain sensations and feelings and abide in the signless concentration, which is a technical, specific form of concentration, it's only when I enter into that kind of concentration that I can have any comfort in my body." So the Buddha's like, this sounds pretty bad, right? Sounds like the Buddha's body is uncomfortable all the time. "Therefore, Ananda," he says, "be islands unto yourselves. Be refuges unto yourselves, seeking no external refuge. With the Dhamma as your island, the Dhamma as your refuge, seeking no other refuge." So what did I leave out that should be added, those of you who are here? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I skipped that part. At one point in his travels, the Buddha had given a talk about mindfulness. That's when I quoted the sutta. Actually, talks about being mindful when you're pissing and shitting, right? Yeah, and I was saying that you know, like, this is a fabulous thing. Like, I don't know of any other religions that make a big deal out of like pissing and shitting as spiritual practices. But this is like a big part of life. It's the older you get, even, you know. For me, pissing and shitting is like, it's like one of the main subjects that I think about every day, right? Right? So if that were not part of my spiritual practice, then, you know, there's hardly any of life left, you know. So yes, mindful peeing, it's a huge practice. You know, you better get into it. It's really good. And in Zen, you know, there's a lot of Zen stories that are like, the whole story is all about, you know, like pissing and shitting is the big deal. So I pointed that out, right? But in that part of the, he's saying, you know, like the whole thing is, he's saying, pay attention to everything. He lists all the things to pay attention to. When you're walking, pay attention to walking. If you're walking forward, pay attention to that. If you're walking backwards, pay attention to that. Standing, walking, sitting, lying down, picking up your bowl, putting down your bowl, putting on your robe, taking off your robe, washing your robe. Pay attention to all of this, including pissing and shitting and everything else. Yeah, pay attention, pay attention, pay attention. And when I think of that, I always think of, you know, Peter Matheson was? He's passed away by now. He was a great American writer. He was a naturalist and wrote many books about nature, but also a novelist and won Pulitzer Prize. And he was a wonderful person. Peter Matheson was a wonderful person. And he died a couple years ago or some years ago. But he was also a Zen teacher. And he used to say that. Pay attention, pay attention, pay attention. And I remember whenever I hear that, the words pay attention, I can see Peter, who was a striking looking fellow, saying that. So it's etched in my mind. Right, so I skipped that. What else did I skip that I might have said last night that was of note? Yeah.
I actually liked myself.
The five disadvantages, you mean?
The five disadvantages.
Yeah, right. Right, right. Let's see. What were they? Yeah. First of all, if you practice immoral conduct, or you don't even just think about your conduct, this kind of shabby conduct, it makes you nervous. The Buddha thought that immoral conduct, since it violates your natural heart, it makes you nervous. It makes you paranoid. That's one disadvantage. Another disadvantage is that if you're an immoral person, people will know it, and you'll have a bad reputation, and that will have consequences for you. Another thing was that if you have immoral conduct, shoddy conduct, which usually has to do with scheming for your own advantage, it will make you paranoid of people. So you'll have this natural sense of wariness about people, and then you'll either become somebody who is like brash and bragging and, you know, to overcome this, or you'll become like a very scared and timid, paranoid person. And I think the other two were, if you're an immoral person, when you come to the end of your life, it's not going to be pretty. You're going to suffer a lot. If all your life you behaved selfishly and stupidly and were not nice to other people, you know, didn't care about other people, when you come to the end, you're going to be in an absolute panic. And the last one was, after the end, after you die, really bad things are going to happen to you. It's really going to be bad. So those are the five disadvantages of unethical, immoral conduct. And I really think it's true. All of those things are really, really true, I think. in a way, they are the answer to the question. When you think about it, it's a stupid idea, a stupid question, a stupid problem. But there's a sort of a perennial spiritual problem of, well, if goodness is good and badness is bad, how come bad things happen to good people? And how come good things happen to bad people? How come people who are terrible, you know, become wildly successful, they live a long life, they have lots of money, and they're happy, they seem to be happy, and whereas somebody who's the best person in the world, you know, gets cancer and dies when they're 35. Why is that? How can that be? And in a way, this answers that. It says, you know, it's not about the wages of immorality, or conversely, of being a kind and moral person are not the objective desserts, right? They are the condition of your heart. You may be successful and live a long life, but your heart is twisted. And you're inside, you know, you might not even realize it, but you're scared, you're paranoid, you're... So anyway, that's right. That is a good one, yeah. What else did I leave out? I'll end up giving the whole talk all over again at this rate. What else did I leave? Yeah. Oh, the music teacher, right. Yeah, that's right. So that wasn't in my talk, but there was a music teacher here last night, and he said, can you give me a metaphor that will help me to, I don't know, understand all this and put it together for my practice? And I said, well, you give me a metaphor. You're a music teacher. You must have metaphors. Because that's what he said. He said, the reason I want a metaphor is because I use metaphors with my music students, and so I'm looking for... You know, I said, well, how about you give me a metaphor. Probably it's the same thing, you know, whatever you tell your music students, probably be just as good for Dharma study. So he said, well, the metaphor I tell them is like gardening. You know, do your practice like a gardener. And I said, oh, that's a great metaphor. And then we went on talking about what a great... In fact, in Buddhism, they use that very metaphor. Not garden, but cultivation. The idea of cultivation, which is an agricultural metaphor. To cultivate fields. And I used to be a farmer at our temple, and I was telling him about how important it is to turn the soil, and then the miracle of plants growing. You didn't grow them, right? You plant the plants, you prepare the soil, you plant the plants, you cultivate the plants, but you don't make the plants grow, right? And it's a miraculous thing. If you're any gardener, it's like, whoa, look at that plant, look how it's flourishing. And you feel, wow, you know, that's a miracle. Sometimes they don't flourish and you don't really sometimes know why, but when they do, you're really happy because you know you didn't do it. You know, somehow it's the life force that makes that happen. It's just like that in practice. You know, you can't do practice. I think we all think of practice as something that we're smart people, we make effort, we're going to do this thing. But you can't do it. You can't. You make the effort, you do what you do, and then by a miracle, somehow or other, if you're lucky, your practice flourishes. But you didn't do it. If you think you did it, it won't flourish. If it seems to flourish, it won't really flourish. So that's right, that came up. What else? Right. Right, the Buddha saw that we're all addicted to basically ourselves. One of my teachers, Bernie Glassman, who was very aware of the recovery community. He used to give Dharma talks, and he used to start his Dharma talks by saying, hi, my name is Bernie. I'm addicted to myself. And it's true, you know. We are addicted to ourselves. And we're addicted to our own pain, I think. Our own personal pain and the drama of our own tragic lives is addictive. We're so fascinated with it. We really want to keep it going. You know, we like it, really. And so the Buddha saw that. The Buddha understood that we're all addicted to ourselves, and it's this addiction that is literally killing us, right? So liberation in Buddhism is really basically being in recovery from that endemic side of being human. So you really understand and have sympathy for people who are addicted to this or that, because you realize, well, whatever they're addicted to, it's only, you know, a specific hook on which they are hanging this human problem. So you realize, you know, yeah, we're all in that boat, in fact. Yeah. Well, I seem to have, like, we're repeating the entire... Anything else? Yes, there's more I left out.
One small point that struck me a lot was that in relationship to the self, there is no self-awakening, there's only awakening.
Right.
All
Right. Yeah, you're saying that. I didn't say that, right?
You said
that. Oh, I did? Oh. Yeah. Right. We don't awaken. Awakening appears in this world for a moment, right? Well, that reminds me of a story. All this reminds me of a story, which I heard the other day from my rabbi. You know, I was in the Yom Kippur services. The other day it was Yom Kippur, you know, when you go and you do your best to atone for your many sins. It's very sad, you know. The services repeat over and over and over and over again until you can't bear it anymore. Lists, long catalogs of sins. And it dawns on you as you're like repeating over and over and over again these long catalogs of sins. At some point it dawns on you that, yes, we have done every single one of these things. Collectively, we've done this. No wonder the world is so sad and pathetic and violent and nasty. No wonder. We've done all this stuff. And by the end, and then you're not eating, you're fasting, right? By the end of the day, you're like a wreck. Ah! You know, why was I even born? You think, you know. Right, so that's every year I go through this, you know. Anyway, my dear rabbi, who's one of the most wonderful people, leads these services. She's like young and robust, and she has a way of, I don't know how she does it, but she's also like one of the greatest singers you ever met. You know, she's like got a great voice and very good singer. And it's all this stuff is sung, you know, with these mournful tunes. Anyway, she said that once upon a time, there was a Hasidic Rebbe who used to travel around from town to town, and he had two stories. Story A, this is how she told it, story A and story B. And story A was a dynamite story. Whenever he told story A, everybody loved it, and he was so charged up. And he could tell it over and over again because he was traveling, you know, and you go to the next town, they didn't hear it, you know, so he'd tell it there. He had story A and story B, and once in a while he'd tell story B, but he really liked story A because, you know, that's the one that got the big response. So he was traveling around, and he went to this one town, some little obscure village somewhere in the Ukraine or something, and he's telling this story, story A, and the room was full of people, and they loved story A, they loved it, and he was thrilled. And they said, you know, this is so wonderful, and you're such a marvelous teacher, that would you please come back again tomorrow night and teach us again? So the next night, he says, I can't tell story A again, so I'll tell story B tonight. So not as good, but it'll be okay. So he goes there, and a whole bunch of people come, and of course, different people come from the one that people that were there yesterday. The room's full of people, and he's looking around, and he doesn't see anybody who was there last night. So he says, great, I can tell story A again. It'll be a fabulous response. But then one person comes in who was there last night. He says, damn. I got to tell story B. Well, you know, it'll be okay. Story B is also a good story. So he tells story B. And it's a pretty good response, not like the night before. Pretty good. And after it's over, everybody goes home except this guy, this one guy who had been there the night before, comes up to him and says to him, Rabbi, you know, I really appreciated your story tonight. It was really wonderful. But I'm a little disappointed. And the rabbi said, why are you disappointed? He said, well, you know, I was so impressed with story A last night that I came back to hear it again. So I took this to heart because as a rabbi traveling around from place to place telling stories, I'm in the same predicament. And I do feel always like if I tell the same story twice, you know, and it's not good. I should have a new story all the time, you know, for people who might have heard it before. However, as I'm getting older and I'm running around more than ever, it really is impractical. So I do repeat things. Not the same thing endlessly, but sometimes I give the same talk two or three times, maybe, instead of just once. I always feel a little guilty about that. I think, oh, no, you know, these people deserve fresh thinking. Nobody should ever come and hear the same thing twice. But the truth of the matter is that it's better if you just have one story and tell it endlessly the same, you know? Or anyway, I mean, because religious teachings are not like a question of innovation, right? You should be innovative or creative or something. No. You should just tell what's true, if possible, right? And if you repeat it over and over and over again, that's good, because actually, at this point in my life, and not in my life, but in our collective lives, we've all been doing this for about 50 years here, right? So it used to be that nobody knew anything about this 50 years ago, and you could say something about meditation, nobody ever heard it before. Now, whenever I go anywhere, I assume that everybody already knows everything. I do. I assume everybody in the room already knows everything I'm going to say. There's nothing I'm going to say that people haven't heard before. People are experienced, right, in doing this. So it's not my job to be telling them what they don't know. It's my job to be reminding them of what they already know. Because that's the only hard part. I really think that spiritual teachings are really simple. I mean, there's almost nothing to them. It's not a big deal. It's not like complicated stuff. It's very simple. And the reason why we're not all enlightened Buddhas, we're behaving all the time like enlightened Buddhas, is not because we don't know what to do or we don't understand the teachings. It's because we forget. You know, we go to the Dharma talk, wow, yeah, right. And the next morning, we forgot all about it. And then the stuff that comes at us is much more compelling to us than our spiritual knowledge and understanding and commitment. And then we find ourselves reacting to everything, and we totally forget about what we heard last night, and we have to hear it again the next night, and the next night, and the next night. We have to repeat it over and over and over again. So it's not a matter of this brilliant thing nobody knows about. It's a matter of just getting together frequently, just like the Vaijins do, in peace and harmony, and reminding each other of what we already know so that we'll remember it more often. That's really all there is to it. So it's okay that I just gave the same Dharma talk I gave last night to the same people, or most of the same people. So, well, and there's hardly much time to go on to the next part of the sutra, but I'll take a few minutes to launch into the next part of the sutra. And leave a few minutes at the end for further comments or questions. Okay. So now I want to bring up what I just read. Did you notice? The Buddha said he overcame his illness by force of will. Did you notice that? That was a little, what does that mean? Can you really do that? Can a Buddha do that? Can anybody, can you say, I'm dying right now, but no, not going to do that. Actually, this happens. You've seen this probably yourself. Somebody's dying, and they actually say, or maybe they don't say it, but it happens, that they're not going to die until so-and-so, who's far away, arrives. So they should be dead, but they're not dead. They're living. That person comes, says goodbye, they die. So somehow, by force of will, they prolong their lives. So then it isn't so hard to imagine that the Buddha, as an awakened person, very much aware of his own impulses, his own desires, his own will, could make a decision that way. My death is coming soon. That may not be preventable, but it won't be today because I have other things that I have to do. And as I just quoted for you, he says, I'm old, my body's just held together with chewing gum. I can't stay alive much longer. And I think the implication is, even if I could, I don't wanna. This is no fun. My body is really falling apart. This is not good. It's not right for me to continue on in this way. The sensations that I'm experiencing on a almost constant basis are entirely unpleasant, and that tells me that it's not right to continue living. So now the Buddha, I think his actions up until this moment tell us that he's aware that he doesn't have long to live. And for him, the living for the Buddha meant only one thing. It meant practicing with people. That's all the Buddha ever did. There's no... the Buddha went on retreats and stuff like that, and sometimes he was alone, but there's no idea that he, like, went to Hawaii, he went to the beach, or, you know, like, he went to an art museum, or took the day off, or didn't practice for that day. There was no thing like that. He was only practicing, always practicing, 45 years, every single day, no vacations. They didn't invent, at that point, the weekend. There was no weekend. So that was the Buddha's life. So now he realizes he's no longer going to be practicing with people. And he feels like that's okay, because everybody's ready. Everybody has what they need. He's given them everything they need. And it's fine for him to leave, to finish up and take his leave. But he needs a little bit more time. And what will he do? So he wants to finish up his relationship with the Sangha in the best way. He feels there's still a few things to do before taking his leave. And this is why he decides to remain alive. Note, though, that although he appears to have the will to decide to live longer, he does not have the will to say to his body, don't be painful anymore. While I'm hanging around here, stop being painful. That apparently was not within his powers. So he decided he would endure these unpleasant sensations of the body for this reason. He says, only when I can get a respite from it by entering into trance meditation, so I get a break from it. But if I'm not in that meditation state, it hurts. And I mention that because I think that nowadays, with all of our science and our careful control and regulation of our lives, I think a lot of us have the unconscious, unexamined thought that if only we exercised enough and ate the right foods and so on and so forth, we would be able to enjoy a good feeling in our bodies indefinitely. Right, there's a kind of unconscious idea that we could do this. And if not, if you have a problem in your body, shame on you. You didn't exercise enough, or in the right way. You didn't get the latest, you know, data to show you that you should have done. You should have exercised this way. Not that you should have. You did 20 minutes. You're supposed to do 25 of those repetitions. If you had done that, you would not have the problem you have now. It's your fault. Now, to be sure, the Buddha didn't have any of that great science that we have. And he was eating what he was given. He wasn't choosing his diet. But still in all, if we imagine that the Buddha, with all of his top-flight mindfulness, was not able to make sure that he didn't physically suffer in his old age, it's possible that we won't be able to prevent that either. That we could have a painful, difficult time with our bodies, even when we're only 80. So now I'm going on to the next part of the sutra. So then the Buddha and Ananda traveled together to the Kapala Shrine. And at the Kapala Shrine, the Buddha said to Ananda, "You know, Ananda, I don't know if you're aware of this, but a really great sage, if he felt like it, could probably live a very long time. I'm 80, you know, but probably a sage could live, you know, 100, 120, probably could live a long time." Well, Ananda did not realize that this was a hint. And Ananda didn't take the hint. Maybe because Ananda was so human, and as we've just learned, so afraid for himself of the Buddha's passing, that his mind was not entirely clear, and he missed this hint. The hint was that he was supposed to have said to the Buddha, "Oh, since a sage can stay alive for more than 100 years, please, Buddha, why don't you stay alive for us?" He didn't say that. That's what the Buddha was hinting. But he didn't say that. So the Buddha repeated the same thing a second time. And Ananda also, this second time, didn't get the hint and didn't say anything. So the Buddha repeated it a third time. And Ananda didn't get it. So right after that, Mara, the evil one, came to visit the Buddha. You all know about Mara, right? Everybody knows who Mara is. So Mara shows up yet again and repeats to the Buddha the same words that he had repeated to him many, many times before, starting on the night of his awakening. That's when Mara said these things first, and now he's repeating them again. And what he said was, then, through the years and on this day, he said, "Now is the time, Buddha. Everything is now complete. Now is the time for you to enter parinirvana and leave this life behind." Now, Mara then goes on, "When I first said this to you a long time ago, you told me then, 'Not yet. Not until there are many, many disciples, many people who have fully taken up the practice, many people who have developed it and can carry it on, then I'll leave.' That's what you said then. You said, 'When that's the case, I'll be ready to let go.' Well, dear Buddha, now really is the time. You have done that. Everything is just as you foresaw many years ago. This really is the time for you to let go." And the Buddha answered, "Well, Mara, don't worry. 3 months from now, I will finally pass away." And with these words, the Buddha, and this is what it says in the text, the Buddha let go of the life force. And when he did that, there was at that moment a huge earthquake. Kaboom! Boom! Everybody was just like in San Francisco. Big earthquake. Tremendous thunder. Everybody noticed something happened. I'll stop there. And we'll go on from there this afternoon. So now we have 10 minutes till lunch. If you have any other comments or questions or reflections, they could have to do with other things. They don't have to just be about the sutra. Yeah, Jason.
You spoke about the practice of signless awareness. Is that a synonym for the nameless awareness in Chula Sanyata Sutta?
Yeah, it's one of the jhanic states, right? It's where basically you... And it's it makes sense because I mean now we understand, like scientists will tell you that we're making the world up, right? In other words, the world, the experience that we have every day of being human and this is happening and there's a sky and I've got feet and hands and I'm walking around, that's a constructed experience that our consciousness produces, right, in response to stimuli from beyond us. If we were to radically change the consciousness, we would have a radically different experience of this world. And so in that state of consciousness, they call it, in Buddhist thought, the sign means the, what would you call it, the essential mooring upon which sensual experience is built. There's like some kind of a something in the consciousness that builds an object that we can cognize. When you dissolve the sign, then you have no, the world dissolves in effect. You're in a state of mind in which the impinging of the world on you ceases to occur. And so that's what the Buddha had to, he had to get himself into that kind of concentration, and then he would no longer feel the sensations of the body. But of course, the trouble with that is, I mean, that you can't, it's this sad, painful world that we need in order to be together, right? If you're in this state of mind where you're removed from the world, you're removed from the world's trouble, but you also can't. So Buddha couldn't practice with people if he was in that state of mind all the time. He would only do that in order to give himself some respite from his pain. So, yeah, but that's what it is, yeah.
What's really going on?
Yeah. Right. Yeah. I think so. Yeah. Well, yeah. Well, yeah. I'm not sure I can repeat it exactly, but he was talking about the idea of being addicted to yourself. And he was saying that seeing that gives you incentive, right? Is that what you're saying? Gives you inspiration to practice. Yeah, you get getting in touch with that in yourself gives you inspiration and a sense of urgency in the practice. Is that what you were saying, more or less? Yeah. Right. So it's kind of an interesting thing because in that sense, somebody could reasonably say, well, forget this Buddhism stuff. No. It's a very bad idea. If I'm suffering and I don't really even know I'm suffering, fine, because I don't know. Why worry about it? In fact, you have to wonder, suffering that's going on that I don't even know is suffering, can you even really say that's going on? Does it even make sense to say it's going on when I don't know it's going on? No, you're going to sit there and like find the suffering that I don't even know is going on, and then you're going to spend the rest of your life dealing with it? That's what you're going to do? Forget that. I'm going to the ball game, you know, I'm fine. That's a reasonable argument, I think, don't you? It's totally reasonable. If somebody said that to me, I would say, yeah, I think you're right, you know, save yourself the trouble. Go to the ball game. But the trouble is, so lucky for that person, maybe. The trouble is, though, that, I guess you would probably say this, is that even before you realized that you were addicted to yourself and there was all this suffering that now comes into view. Even before you realize that, there was something that was disturbing you somehow. Now, sometimes the something that's disturbing you is, my life just fell apart, you know? I got sick. My spouse left me. I lost my job. Something fell apart. And that gave me a big wake-up call. And now I couldn't just go to the ball game anymore because I was so miserable, I had to address it. That happens. In fact, more or less, it always happens, right? Because if you don't lose your spouse, your job, your health, you die eventually. Something happens. That's one problem. The other problem is sometimes none of that happens, but you just have this feeling like, this is not right, this life I'm living. Something about it that doesn't, I have a yearning, I have a longing, I have something in me doesn't let me be satisfied with all this stuff that I've worked hard to achieve. I got married, I got my career, I've got this, I've got that, but it doesn't really, there's something there more. And then you start investigating, and then things get worse, like you say, much worse. Then you realize, oh my God, it's a catastrophe. I didn't even know it. I had this little nagging thing. Now it turns out the whole thing is... So I always say, you know, Buddhist practice makes your life far worse. It does. Because now you realize this is a way bigger thing than I ever thought it was, you know. It's a total catastrophe thing here. I knew I was going to die, but I didn't realize I was dying constantly. And that time is going by so fast that my death might as well be tomorrow, you know. Stuff like that. But there's a great joy in the end. The joy of, here's the thing. In the end, the greatest joy of all, and the only thing that satisfies a human life, in my opinion, is to live a life that's completely real. Right? To know, this is my real life. This is not some cooked up concept of a life. This is my real life. Yes, there are problems here, human problems, but I'm facing them, and there's a joy in living my real life because everybody's living that same life, whether they know it or not. And then you have a lot of love, and a lot of you look at people and you say, wow, you know, here's another pathetic human being just like me. You know, and look at how that person is. Look at what a mess they are. It's so beautiful, actually. It's really beautiful when you realize that this is us. So that, in other words, not only is there the satisfaction of knowing you're living a real life, but there's also a lot of love and a lot of understanding for other people because you realize, wow, you know, we're all in this together. It's the same for everybody. And the whole thing, you know, being a person is basically being standing like this all the time, you know. Oh, you like me? Oh, wonderful. But that was yesterday. Right? I mean, that's us, right? But then you don't have to do that anymore, right? You don't have to do that anymore. You just... So, yeah, it's a wonderful path. But, you know, if anybody tells you that it's peaceful, it's lovely, it's wonderful, you know, you were unhappy before, now just go to the Buddhist center and everything will be fine. It just, that doesn't work that way, you know, unfortunately. So yes, we turn toward our suffering with some sense of urgency and realism, and we find that the path of our suffering is the path of our liberation. It's the same. Same thing. Well, anyway, now you have to go eat food. That's another problem, you know. So enjoy your lunch. We'll be back at 1:30 and we'll start with sitting. So maybe why don't we maybe come in and just go ahead and begin sitting, and we'll do the same routine we did this morning, sitting, walking, sitting, and then talking. So thanks very much. You're wonderful people. I'm having fun. Thank you.
All right, I have a couple of announcements for lunch. One, I'll need a couple volunteers to help set up and put away some tables here and move some chairs so that people can eat in here. You're also welcome to sit back under the coat rack or eat on the carpet back there. We also have the fourth side up there, so if you're interested in doing that, you'll need to go out and drink up there. We ask you not to use the restrooms up there and to bring whatever you brought up back down. And I'll be up there about 15 minutes, roughly. Also, I had a request that if anyone that came in...
Would it be silent in this room and talking upstairs, or silent in both places, or is there any... doesn't matter?
So noble silence in here and up there. Noble silence in here, and if you would like to talk up there, I think a lot of times we leave that open. Okay? Any questions? All right.